So this has been just a huge week of news when it comes to U.S. foreign policy. We've had bombshell revelations in the impeachment slash Ukraine-related hearings. We have had a Democratic debate where there was a pretty extensive foreign policy discussion. And we want to sort of make sense of what's going on and, most importantly, talk to somebody who has some really big ideas about all of this. And that is Senator Michael Bennet from Colorado. He is one of the Democratic presidential candidates. And he is here in the studio in D.C. with me on Worldly, part of the Vox Media Podcast Network. Hello, Senator.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thank you. Thank you. Thanks for taking some time. I understand you're traveling today.
Yeah, I'm off to actually spend 4 days in New Hampshire.
Oh, yeah. I've heard of that state, and I believe it's kind of important, right?
It is
presidential thing.
It's important. People take it very seriously up there, which is good. It reinvigorates your faith in democracy.
Yeah, it's the place that I've done the most live canvassing because I went to school in New England, and it's actually really fun.
Yeah.
Back when I was a college student. All right. But, you know, as much as I'd like to talk about New Hampshire and Hills and how pretty it is, I think it's probably time that we maybe talk about the world and foreign policy. And I want to start with impeachment, which, you know, it seems like it's a domestic political issue right now, and it's mostly analyzed through the lens of, are Republicans going to vote for it? What is going to happen? But it's at its heart, right, it's a foreign policy issue, right? It's about two things. It's about first, and most obviously, the hijacking of American foreign policy for the president's personal gain. And two, it's sort of a pointer about the inherent risks of an international order where so many countries depend on the United States so fundamentally for their security, right? So is that how you see it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that actually this era, you need to think about it in those terms because what we're seeing in the world is what happens when there's a vacuum of American leadership. We've never seen a vacuum like the one we have right now. And that's even before impeachment. Now we're tied up with this. But when I, you know, if you travel in Europe or you travel in Asia, what you hear people say is, we're waiting for you guys to come back because we can't do what we need to do without you. The Europeans feel that way with respect to the Russians. The Asians feel that way with respect to China. And now, of course, we're in the middle of this trial of basically this gang of grifters in the White House who have tried to turn our American foreign policy into a means of their own political survival.
Gang of grifters, it's like an evocative phrase, but it's also, I don't think, one that's only applicable to the leadership in the United States right now. Right, we are in the midst of, and you actually gave a speech about this in part at the Council on Foreign Relations the night before we're taping. We're in the midst of a real problem, a crisis era in democracy globally. Right, this is not just an American problem. Help me understand why, from your point of view, this is happening.
Start in the U.S. and then we can talk about the rest of the world
absolutely.
If you're interested. But let's start here. So I can remember the night that Barack Obama was elected president, and he was standing in Grant Park in Chicago. I was the superintendent of the Denver Public Schools. I wasn't in politics, or at least not in, you know, partisan politics. And I sort of felt like we'd reached the pinnacle of our civilization. To me, it was just extraordinary that the children in my school district, most of whom are kids of color, would now, when they thought about who a president was, would think, well, that looks like Barack Obama. And by the way, no matter what happens, that will always be true, and that will always be something that was great. What I did not anticipate, and I don't think most people did, was the forces of reaction that would set in beginning that evening when Barack Obama was elected. Now, obviously, democracies have these forces of reaction, but we haven't seen it in ours in a very long time. We have been suffering with that ever since. And this band of people that showed up here who called themselves first the Tea Party and then the Freedom Caucus came to Washington to dismantle our exercise in self-government. At the same time, the Supreme Court rendered a terrible decision in Citizens United, and we had the effect of the partisan gerrymandering in the last decade. And you combine those things together with the collapse of edited content and print media, which might be good for Vox, but may not be good for the democracy.
Hey, we do editing.
Yeah, well,
as much
true.
As this podcast
that's true.
May sound differently.
I say that's true. Yeah. You take all of that together, and our democracy is under siege. We are under siege. Then we had the king of the Freedom Caucus show up, Donald Trump. Nobody was expecting him, including the Freedom Caucus. He shows up, a reality TV star, and says, I alone can fix it. That's what he said. That's the opposite of the way a democracy is supposed to work. So, and he has governed as a reactionary tyrant. That is what he has done. And so we are under deep, deep pressure as a democracy, and it's true all over Europe as well.
So I want to push you on this notion of there being reactionary forces. This is a topic that's near and dear to my heart. And I also think important to understanding the broader global scene, right? Not just in the US. This is not, again, an isolated phenomenon. When you say reactionary forces, what do you mean specifically? What drives people to become part of this reactionary bloc?
In the case of Trump, a feeling that, you know, the demography of the country is changing, that the country, that we're losing the country that we all grew up in and knew. I don't agree with any of that, but I think there's a sense of that. In our case, something that I do agree with is the effect of 50 years of an economy that, when it grew, served only the top 10% of the American people. I mean, the most working people in this country have been living in a recession for the last 50 years. And you see that lack of economic mobility where 9 out of 10 Americans don't see their pay go up. And you see the costs of housing, healthcare, higher education, and early childhood education go up. The vast majority of people that I meet in my town halls in Colorado, which is one of the most dynamic economies that we've got in the country, the vast majority of them can't afford those things and therefore can't afford a middle-class life, can't set something aside for their kids. The kids that I used to work for in the Denver Public Schools, who are mostly kids of color, mostly living in poverty, their families would say, we're killing ourselves, and no matter what we do, we can't get our kids out of poverty. So there's also a big reaction to that. And just to finish the thought,
yeah,
the mobilization of our exercise in self-government, people didn't— they didn't know who to blame for it. You know, they didn't know about the Tea Party. They didn't really know about the Freedom Caucus. And so what they said was, we got to just blow the place up because we can't do any worse. So let's send Trump in there to blow the place up. Now, when I meet people at home who voted for Trump, I ask them, well, why'd you vote for him? And they say, well, because we wanted to blow the place up. And I say, congratulations. You achieved your objective. Yeah. What are we going to do for our kids and our grandkids? And what are we going to do for America's place in the world?
Right. Now I want you to globalize that analysis for me. Do you think that this is the same situation in the U.S. and in European democracies or other advanced democracies that are facing similar problems, like Israel, for example?
Today they can't form a government.
Yeah.
I haven't been in Israel in the last year, so—
I was there last week, so okay, it's fresh in my mind.
But, but I do think there are similarities in all these places, in Western Europe and in Israel. You know, I believe that we're seeing this in the midst of our primary election for the Democratic nomination in America right now, where you basically have two primaries going on. You've got a social media primary going on where people are genuflecting to whatever the Twitter universe wants on a given day, whatever Facebook wants on a given day. And then you got the real people that are living in Iowa and New Hampshire who actually are not obsessed with politics and obsessed with social media in the same way, and they've got a whole different agenda. I see the distorting effects of that every single day. And I think that we saw that in Brexit, have seen it in Brexit. I think we're seeing it in the Israelis' inability to form a government. And what it really means is that America can't take a vacation from the world, which is what we're doing right now, because all of Western democracy is under siege. And at the same time, by the way, tyrants are becoming stronger. I mean, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, we wouldn't have said that. Certainly, when the Berlin Wall fell, we wouldn't have said that. But now when you look at Erdogan and when you look at the Putin in Russia, the rise of China most spectacularly, the advances that Iran has made since we toppled Saddam Hussein, the world looks very different than it did.
I want to get to that, the sort of increasing authoritarian emboldenment in a second, but I want to ask for specifically, you know, you're running for president, right? So these are problems that theoretically, if you were to win the nomination, you would try to solve. So what would you do to repair the internal erosion of democracy in America's pure allies?
I believe that we need an international alliance to save democracy. We're being assaulted, and we need to pay attention to it as an assault on our democracy. And we save, as I said, we have a lot of things in common. So when you see what the Russians have done with social media in Western Europe and here, that requires a concerted response from Western democracies. When you see China rising the way it has risen, that requires a concerted effort by Western democracies. And what does all of that mean? To me, it means strengthening the alliances that we have. When I'm in town halls in Iowa and New Hampshire, almost always there's one foreign policy question. It's almost always the same, which is, what are you going to do to strengthen our alliances? The American people are seeing this president retreat from those alliances, which he thinks is just his own reaction to Barack Obama. You know, whatever Obama did, I'm going to do the opposite. The reality is he's rejecting 70 years of American foreign policy. He's rejecting 70 years of alliances that have been tended by Republican and Democratic presidents. If I am elected president, the first thing that I'll do is go to Europe and mend the alliances that we have there.
What does that mean specifically? Does it mean being nicer to them, right? Does it mean giving more aid?
I think it means sanctioning Russia for interfering in our elections. That's what I think it begins with.
Gotcha. So that's the first, like, you know, day one kind of policy. We start heavier sanctions on Russia. Now, Israel's kind of a different case, right? Because their democratic backsliding, the issues that they're having with forming a government relate heavily not just to the prime minister and the corruption charges that he's very likely to be facing soon, but also some real deep structural problems in that country relating to the occupation and its relationship with the Palestinians. When I was there last week, I saw what the West Bank was like on the ground. I saw the way the Palestinian towns were being basically snuffed out economically by restrictions created by the occupation. And I talked to Israelis in civil society who said that the rules that started to govern what's happening in the West Bank have started to make it difficult for them to operate in a free democracy in the way that you're supposed to. So how does that – when you talk about strengthening alliances, how do you think about the U.S. relationship with Israel going forward?
Well, it is obviously our most important alliance in the Middle East. That is what I would say to begin with. I think it's essential that both of us think very hard about what it is to be a democracy. When I hear the prime minister say that Donald Trump is the best friend that Israel has ever had, when Donald Trump is the most anti-immigrant and most anti-refugee president that there has been in my lifetime, it's very hard to square that circle when the president has been as anti-democratic, small d democratic, as Donald Trump has had. It's hard to square that circle. On the other hand, there's a lot in the prime minister that's reflected in Donald Trump, and they're similar characters in a lot of ways.
Expand on that thought.
Well, I think that they've sort of conflated the interests, the identity of their country with themselves. They both govern as strongmen, I think, and as autocrats. And they're both anti-democratic in a sense. The issue in Israel is that, and this is in fairness to the prime minister, that nobody else has made a convincing enough case about on the security issues for people to give somebody else a chance to come in and form a government and do something different, because there is no domestic constituency right now really on either side for a two-state solution or to figure out how to put a peace process together. And in the absence of that, people's understandable priority is going to be security. And Bibi Netanyahu, has won that argument. And for the moment, we're having that sort of contradiction. So I don't think that America or Israel can be America or Israel unless we have strong democratic traditions that go forward, unless we embrace in our own way our commitment to pluralism. And what I worry about in both countries is that pluralism is being assaulted and sectarianism is rising as it is in the rest of the world.
Would you think it's appropriate to use policy tools, leveraging aid, diplomatic support, to push Israel in towards a two-state solution?
I think we should push Israel toward a two-state solution, because that is the right solution. It is very difficult to figure out what the levers are that you can pull that don't immediately become just chum in the water of our domestic politics. And so I think we need to be careful about that and careful about threats that are made.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to keep getting into it with Senator Bennett. I want to talk about pressure on another American ally in the Middle East, because a second ago you were talking about global authoritarianism and the increasing willingness of them to project power abroad. And it's true that there are some countries that are, if not American enemies, at least American rivals potentially, like Russia and China, that you can point to. But they aren't the only ones that are doing this. And to me, perhaps the most brazen example of authoritarian overreach in recent years, like very recent memory, is the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi by a U.S. ally, Saudi Arabia, and ordered from the top by the Crown Prince. That, in some ways, it's an even more difficult situation when thinking about how to manage it than Israel is. So this was also a big topic in last night's Democratic debate, as I'm sure you saw. So let's talk about Saudi Arabia, because it's a real problem for the United States.
Well, it's what Trump has done is pitiful. So he is reacted to the murder of a journalist, Khashoggi, who is living here in America and who was lured to Turkey to be assassinated by cut to pieces by bone saws. And what you'd expect from an American president is to stand up for the free press. And instead, first he said, well, it would be terrible if it turned out that MBS was involved. And of course, that is what our intelligence agencies concluded. And then Trump's reaction was, well, I'm not going to cancel, arms shipments to Saudi Arabia because it will affect our economy. It's a ridiculous statement.
It definitely is.
It's like he is behaving as though we are this pathetic, weak, transactional nation. And instead, I think that we should have, sanctioned them, canceled arms shipments. Should be clear that they need to end the war in Yemen. And we should be clear that we're not going to accept this kind of tyrannical behavior. Again, this journalist was living here. I mean, it would matter if the journalist were living in Saudi Arabia. But the journalist was living here writing for the Washington Post. And if we don't stand up when somebody is killed like that under those circumstances, nobody else will. And other tyrants will kill other journalists. And pretty soon you're not living in a free society. That's, to go back to our earlier conversation, this is what's at risk. Our democracy is at risk. Donald Trump is a symptom of the issues that we're facing. He is not the essential cause of them. But when you look at the range of things, from the U.S. not standing up for Khashoggi to, the effect that Facebook is having on our democracy, the Russian interference on Facebook as well, we're under a lot of pressure. And the only people that can save the democracy are the American people themselves. As Jefferson said, there's nobody else to answer the fire bells at night besides citizens, and that's what we need to do.
It's really interesting to hear you put Saudi Arabia murdering a journalist and Facebook basically in the same sentence next to each other. It almost sounds like you think Facebook is a national security threat.
Well, it is. They wouldn't admit that Russia was on the site to begin with. Then they finally, a year later or something, they finally did. And they have had an incredibly corrosive effect on our democracy.
And not just ours, right? It sounds like you were talking earlier about
true.
Social media
affecting That's true.
European
it's true all over
democracy.
The world. Yeah. And I don't mean to sound like some sort of Luddite. I'm not a Luddite. I think that there is a cancerous effect of what's happening, and I don't believe Zuckerberg and these guys have any understanding of what the effect is on the democracy.
This is a huge problem then, right? Because Facebook is something like 75% of the global population. The number's rough, but I remember seeing that in a survey a few years ago or on Facebook. What do we do, right? If this is a national security threat, a paramount problem for democracy, not just here but everywhere— It seems like you really need to propose some kind of radical action.
Well, I'll give you a small example of something somebody did. The CEO of Twitter a month ago said, we're not going to sell political advertising on Twitter. That was the act of a patriot. That was somebody who was looking at the situation and saying, you know what? We're helping wreck the democracy as well. We're going to stop doing that. On Facebook, I think these guys have got to figure out a way to present news so that it doesn't so it's not presented in the context of algorithms that are meant to tear the American people apart from each other, reinforce their most base instincts, and instead give us a conversation that we need to have to support the democracy. And they ought to be just on their own willing to do that. But if they're not willing to do it, I think we need to think about what regulations we need to put in place to better police what's going on.
Would you be willing to consider breaking up the big tech companies?
I'm certainly willing to think about that. I have not said that we should do it. But when you look at the return on invested capital of these big tech companies, this is an aspect of this challenge that's seldom talked about by anybody but me. I don't know, maybe nobody else cares about it. But when you look at the return on invested capital from these companies, you would expect that line, and that line usually is flat. You know, I'm drawing a straight line across this room that
listeners,
we're sitting.
I can see him. I can see him doing
this.
It's
audio visual part of the podcast. And it's usually flat. Why is it flat? It's flat because if you start to get an outsized profit, I'm now drawing a line going up, you start to get an outsized profit, someone else comes and competes you down. Since 1995, those companies, their lines have gone straight up because nobody can compete their profits down. And that suggests that there is a distortion in the market that we need to take a hard look at.
I mean, this kind of problem, right? This is just one aspect of it. And already we're talking about a really massive, massive potential policy solution. I know you're not committing to breaking up the big tech companies, but at least we need to discuss it, right? And that's just one slice of this problem that we're talking about right now.
But think about on those guys, they have essentially been utterly unregulated since the day that they started.
Right.
And in the beginning, the regulatory environment was one that appropriately treated them as small startup companies. That has obviously changed. They've transformed our economy. And it's, I think, well past time for us to go back and for DOJ or whoever the appropriate authority is to investigate and to make some judgments about whether or not they're too big.
I mean, in the 1890s, the U.S. saw economic policy as a key part of its rise to global prominence, right, and regulating and controlling the market. And a key part – I mean, I guess this is a little bit later, but a key part of President Roosevelt at the time's agenda was, in fact, busting up giant companies to ensure American dynamism.
And what one could say, I think, without exaggerating it, is just as Roosevelt was living in a gilded age, we're living in another gilded age. And to your point – that gilded age didn't end itself. It required the trust busting that went on. It required Americans to come together and say, we're going to amend the Constitution of the United States so that women have the right to vote. We're going to amend the Constitution of the United States so that we're no longer allowing senators to bribe their way into the Senate by paying off state legislatures who then appointed them to the Senate. And then the senators came to Washington and gave themselves railroad rights of way. You know, we fixed that. We addressed that. And in our time, when you look at the effect of Citizens United, it seems to me that the requirement on us is similar, which is we've got to amend the Constitution to overturn Citizens United. For me, that's not just a rhetorical point. That's something that's a piece of business we need to do.
I think you're hitting on a really profound point here. And it's not just a political point or a narrow geostrategic one, but it's actually kind of a moral one, right? Which is these resources that are being created in the developed world, they're not just done by one person, right? They're not done by some entrepreneur sitting in his basement. It's a system not just of American regulatory policy, but global economic policy set basically by the actions of billions of people that allow these companies to profit in such a way. And to me, when there's such a deep web of interconnection, it suggests that we owe a great deal more to people in the developing world. People who we didn't just get all of this money on our own, right? It comes in part due to, sadly, a history of exploitation, an ongoing system that gives residents of the first world advantages and legs up by sheer dint of where they're born. How do you think about problems of global redistribution, not just domestic redistribution, of dealing with a fundamentally and deeply unequal world?
Well, I think that we have a very interesting moment in front of us because the one thing I'll say positive about Trump is that I think he was right to call the question on China. I just think he did it in completely the wrong way. And that is the big piece of business for the world. And the United States, I think, in many ways shares equities with almost every other country of the world vis-a-vis China and the rise of China except maybe Russia and North Korea. And that includes all of Latin America. That includes all of Africa. And I think and Asia, we can lead a coalition of countries that is engaged in a process of trying to create a more felicitous trading arrangement with China as China grows. That'll have big implications in Africa. That'll have big implications in Latin America. And it has huge implications for us, which is why we have to do it. And I think that we haven't really had a way of organizing our thoughts since essentially the Cold War started or ended, and then we were hit on 9/11. We've sort of been disoriented ever since then. The rise of China gives us an opportunity to orient ourselves and orient a lot of other people in the world to figure out how the global economy grows in a way that actually supports humans. And so that's one important point. Second, I'd say that we have to make a case to the American people about why our foreign assistance is as important as it is. And I don't think we've made that case in a long time. And that may come with figuring out how to reform some of our international institutions, including the UN, so they're less bureaucratic. And so people around the world actually can see economic opportunity out of investments that are made by these organizations, not just the sustaining the position that they're in. When I'm in a refugee camp where there are people that have been there or families that have been there for 70 years, you sort of say to yourself, this isn't the way it was supposed to work. At some point, people are supposed to be able to get up out of this place and get on their own feet. And that's something I think we could be helpful in as well.
Let me put the question differently.
Okay.
I've seen some left-wing academics and writers make the argument that we owe essentially a duty of reparations, we being the broader West here, both the United States and Europe, for colonialism, imperialism, mm-hmm. various different things that could be cashed out in two different ways. One, through just pure foreign aid, as you're describing, or two, a more open immigration policy that would allow more people from these other countries, these sort of historically disadvantaged countries, to come into the United States. Do you think that's the right way to think about it?
I think – you know what I think? I think that as long as the vast majority of children in America can't get a decent education, we ought to be focused on that question. And it really aggravates me that we're not. That's what I think.
You think there's a trade-off there between global justice and domestic justice?
There is, because there's a question of, you know, what is politically sustainable? And are you actually going to make progress? For some reason that I don't understand, the kids of color in America's schools are almost completely invisible to a lot of people in America that are engaged in politics. I don't understand why.
So let me ask you a somewhat related question to this sort of broad architecture of the global reality we've been talking about so far. The U.S. foreign policy track record of the past 20 years is not good,
mm-mm.
right? It's quite bad if you just look at what we've done in terms of new initiatives. Do we need to rethink the idea that the United States needs to be the military hegemon? I don't necessarily think we do, but it seems like our track record, and not just recently, right? All of the things that we did during the Cold War that really are quite awful in terms of abuses of people.
Yeah.
Beyond our borders? Do we need to scale down our global presence because the risks of hegemony are too high?
I think we need to – I think what the greatest contribution we can make to the world, I think, are our values. And we have never perfectly expressed those. We've never perfectly manifested those. We have imperfectly expressed those. We have imperfectly manifested those. But I can say this as the, you know, son of a Polish Jew who survived the Holocaust and the grandson of Polish Jews who survived the Holocaust, the idea of America means something to people around the world. And that's really important to me because there is no other country in the world that can express a commitment to pluralism, that can deny the value of sectarianism the way the United States can. And that's what we should stand for. I agree that we should learn from our mistakes. I mean, I flew back from Nevada on Monday or Tuesday, Monday, I guess, and I started reading the Army College report on Iraq. Every American should read that, at least the beginning of it, to see the catastrophic failures of judgment that we made. I mean, we think about, for example, Rumsfeld saying, we're going to be welcomed with open arms. We're going to be greeted as liberators, like when we arrived in Paris, you know. And we completely failed to understand what the effect of sanctions had been on the Iraqi population during the 10 years leading up to the Iraq War. Utterly failed to understand it. And we can't afford to make those mistakes. As I said earlier this week in the speech you talked about earlier, a huge reason why Trump was elected was the Iraq War. People don't understand that, but it's true because it's viewed by the – when Trump was running, I can remember sitting there in my office, and he was about to run in the South Carolina primary. It was the next day, and the commentators were saying he's going to lose in South Carolina because he attacked Bush on the Iraq War. And I was sitting there thinking, no, he's not, because the people in South Carolina know better than anybody else what a catastrophe that war has been. They agree with Donald Trump. And so I think that we've got to think, you know, we've got to learn from our mistakes, and we have a huge amount of work in front of us thinking about what metadata looks like in terms of our national security, what artificial intelligence looks like in terms of our national security. And we're not thinking about that stuff. China is thinking about that stuff, and it worries me. I mean, you could wake up tomorrow morning and there are a bunch of water drones wandering around New York Harbor that cost virtually nothing to produce, you know.
Right.
We're not even thinking about that stuff.
So, I mean, we've been talking about mostly problems right now, but I want to talk a little bit about solutions, starting with the current president. Is there anything that he's done that's worth keeping? Anything?
The only thing I'd say is calling the question on China. He did it in the wrong way. He shouldn't have put tariffs on our allies. Right. That's it. Everything else, I think, has been, from a foreign policy perspective, has been born out of his ignorance and his fundamental weakness. There's no other president in the history who would have done what he did in northern Syria. You know, I mean, there's a situation where, unlike all the misadventures that you were talking about earlier in Iraq, you know, here's a case where for 5 years we basically put ISIS in a box. We lost six guys, which is tragic, but it's six guys. The Kurds lost 11,000 people. And we're going to abandon the Kurds under those circumstances? And then even worse than that, because Trump, you know, then starts to freak out about, well, maybe I'm getting criticized because I'm taking people out, so I'm going to lead people in. So what's the rationale going to be? We're there to protect the oil field. So now everybody in the Middle East, their worst assumption about what it is we're doing there has now been borne out by the words that the president is using. It's incredible. This isn't a foreign policy point, but the one thing where the guy took a hard line on anything was vaping, where, you know, Melania apparently got interested in this. And so he said, well, I'm going to go after the vapors. 10 minutes of people saying, we're not going to vote for you. And he flips. His foreign policy is the same.
That's a good way of putting it. Look, I know you have to leave, but I want to ask you one last, like, yes or no, up or down question. Based on everything that you've been talking about, everything we've learned this week at the impeachment hearing, are you prepared to vote to convict the president?
I think that if the evidence continues to bear up what has been established so far, the answer to that is yes.
Senator Bennett, thank you so much, and good luck on your presidential campaign.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
This is great. I want to make sure to thank our engineer, Malachi Brodus. I want to thank our producer, Jackson Bierfeldt. I also want you to go take a look at another Vox Media podcast, Reset, who this week did a really interesting report on Iran that you should check out. The episode was on Iran's shutdown of the internet to hide big protests, and it's really cool. And you listen to them or you listen to us, we encourage you to rate, subscribe, and review the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks a lot. Bye.